Welcome back to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, my co-host Felicity Signal-Reed, and our guest this week, Ronald Mackay. In Fortunate Isle Run, you tell about many characters who are almost larger than life. There's Donna, the matriarch of the pension you lived in. There's Juan, Francisco, Pepe, and so on. And you seem to get on with all of them. Was there anybody you found difficult to get on with?
I can't say there was. I did have one run-in with the local mayor. What happened was that one day he turned up at the pension where I lived with a form urging me to sign it. Now, in those days, in the early 60s, Spain was at war in a small enclave in southern Morocco called Ifni, and they were recruiting young men to go and fight in Ifni. And I was afraid, not knowing Spanish very well, that I might be ending up as a member of the Spanish Legion to be shipped off to fight in southern Morocco. And so I refused to sign the paper. He did everything he possibly could to persuade me, and I ended up walking away from him because I did not want to sign. Later, I discovered that he was simply showing me the respect of including me in the village census.
Oh,
I was the only
difference.
Foreigner who lived there, and they wanted to take pride in the village having accepted a foreigner. That was the only run-in that I had.
Did you ever have a chance to sort that out with him?
No, unfortunately, I didn't. My walking away from such an important person broke the relationship, and he never looked at me again.
Now, amongst all that cast of characters, if you were to single out just one person who you found particularly influential, who might that be?
That's a good question. My answer comes after having written the book. I didn't realize until I was writing it and rereading it that Doña Lutgarda, who was the matriarch of the pension where I lived, she owned the pension, and it was run by herself, her three daughters, and her niece. She was a major influence on me during that period of time. She would nudge me from time to time or discreetly provide me with information about how best to conduct myself in social matters in the village. She was also the one who found me my first job and put a good word into the banana plantation for my second job. So she was really the major influence that I encountered during my year in the Canary Islands, and I dedicate the book to her.
Oh, that's nice. Now, going to a completely different spot on the atlas here, your first memoir was in Romania and was published by the online press of Bucharest University. This new one appeared at the 5 months after you completed the manuscript. How did you manage to publish so quickly?
I've been very pleasantly surprised about how quickly I've managed to publish. Very pleasantly surprised. They happened in very different ways. I won't talk about the last one. Mm-hmm. I'll talk about the current one. In 2016, I came across a novel called Poaching the River by Rod Fleming and discovered that all of the dialogue was written in the dialect that I grew up speaking until I was 5 years old. I was intrigued by the book and loved it, and I wrote a review on Amazon for that book, and the author contacted me. We then began to exchange notes on Facebook for 5 or 6 months. He's about 15 or 20 years younger than me, quite a different kind of person, but a wonderful writer. When I mentioned to him that I was going to write my second memoir during the winter of 2016, he said he would read the manuscript for me. So I was pleased to have a professional novelist read my manuscript. It turned out that he also owns a publishing house.
Oh my.
And a week after he read my manuscript, he said they would like to publish it.
Wow.
And that was how quickly it happened. So we've spent this summer, the past 4 months, getting it into the form that you have in your hands now.
Well, universe was certainly smiling on you that day that you wrote the review. Now, you mentioned that this is the first time you've worked closely with an editor. How has that experience been for you, and what were the challenges?
Well, it's the first time I've worked with an editor, and the experience was absolutely ideal. After reading my manuscript, Rod Fleming, who was the editor himself, he wrote a long report listing all the things that he thought I should do to make the book publishable. Since I'm not a publisher, nor an editor, but have worked with professionals all my life, I put myself in his hands and I addressed every single one of his suggestions in the way that he made them. And so we worked seamlessly together. I didn't fight. I accepted cutting my favorite chapter out, cutting chapters of 4,000 words down to 500 words, and we worked wonderfully together. And as a result, the book is far better than the manuscript was, and the story is tighter and more focused.
Well, that's music to my ears, because I'm an editor, and and I know from the editor's side of the desk that any suggestions made are only to make the book a better product. You know, it's never to take the writer down or anything like that. So it's good to hear that somebody actually put trust in
that's
in
exactly
their editor.
What I felt he was doing, yeah. And I trusted him to do it.
Yeah. So do you have any plans for any more books? And if so, will they be memoirs?
Indeed, I do have more plans. Last year, I was tossing up between writing a novel and the memoir that has currently been published. And this winter in Peru, I'm going to write another book, and I'm tossing up whether it should be a novel or another memoir about the 10 years that Viviana and I spent growing grapes in Argentina.
Hmm.
So I haven't made up my mind yet.
You'll see when you get started,
yes,
where it takes you. Yeah, wonderful. Well, I'd love to hear some more from Fortunate Isle, if you would.
This is from the chapter called Dynamite, and I'll give you the background first. One Sunday, I was in a small fishing launch called a falua with fishermen from a neighboring village en route to spend the day with the lighthouse keeper and his family at Teno. On the way, to save time, they dynamited fish to take with them as a contribution to the meal. The fishermen explained to me that there was no civil guard launch on our shore, and so the chance of being caught with illegally caught fish was minimal. Here we go. We were just finishing the last of the fresh tuna and potatoes when Jose, who had gone up into the lantern room to make his meteorological observations, rushed back down. "The civil guard launch has left Santa Catalina. It's on its way over here at full throttle." Santa Catalina is the port on the neighboring island of La Gomera, 30 kilometers away. Sebastian leapt to his feet. He made his living from the falua and couldn't have it confiscated. "Let's go, now. We'll outrun them." Suddenly, everybody was in frantic motion. We went roaring back up the coast towards Los Silos. The current was against us, and the going was heavy. Sebastian and his first hand were discussing how best to make it back before the civil guard could catch us. Sebastian addressed me. They called me Orlando. "Orlando," he said, "if they overtake us, it won't be pleasant, and to be caught with a foreigner will be worse." Now my excitement turned to concern. Spain was run by a single-minded dictator who brutally crushed all opposition, and I'd no desire to experience the inside of a Spanish jail. For a split second, I feared that they might be planning to toss me overboard. "We'll drop you off round on the headland. You can make a run for it over the mountains. It's no more than 12 kilometers. If you get home, lie low. We'll take our chances." I noticed the "if you get home." Well, they dropped me off on a rock near the shore, and I began running, first across the desert, then up into the mountains. On the plateau below the mountain tops, the path leveled off, but at that very moment, a massive grey wall of mist enveloped everything. I could see only tiny droplets, carried like shining white pearls in the fog, that told me somewhere far above, the sun was still shining. Terrified to move quickly, in case I might plunge to my death, I cast about to see if there was any clue at all that might help. A sickening panic began to rise in the pit of my stomach. I was lost on high mountains, split by steep canyons, robbed of my most valuable asset, my sense of direction. Suddenly, in front of me, I saw a sheep, its wool a mass of water droplets. Behind it, also stock still, stood a little girl. She was barefoot and wore a white dress and a shapeless yellow woolen cardigan. She smiled out of a weather-beaten face. My fear evaporated. If a child was up here, grazing her sheep, I was saved. Buenos dias. I'm el extranjero from Buena Vista. I'm lost. Can you tell me how to get back to the village? She nodded and pointed into the mist. But where's the path? She pointed again. Isn't there a path? She frowned, turned, and called, Abuelito, Grandpa. Out of the fog, Grandpa appeared. He wore a black hat, a shirt without a collar, and carried a crook. We shook hands. Yes, he'd heard of me, el extranjero from Buena Vista. I must get back to the village, fast. Can you help me? Just follow the path, he smiled. One of life's greatest challenges is to try to put ourselves into others' shoes. From the comfort of our own footwear, we tend to assume that others know what we know, believe what we believe, and see the world as we see it. Neither the girl nor Grandpa imagined that I could possibly be lost in such a familiar place. Señor, I said, I'm not familiar with these mountains, nor their paths. Can you help me get down safely into the valley? He turned to his granddaughter. The foreigner has managed to get himself lost. She looked at me in wonder. Take him to the edge of the cliff path. Won't you come with me? Your granddaughter might not find her way back to you. They both laughed. Meekly, I followed the child through the blinding mist until, suddenly, we were in warm sunshine again. 1,000 feet below, I could see Buena Vista crouched on the plain like a lone crab. I felt acutely embarrassed for my earlier panic and my unashamed plea for assistance. It had taken a 7-year-old child, who may never have attended school for a single day in her life, mere minutes to resolve my problem. I turned to thank her, but she'd already withdrawn into the silent mist.
Oh, wow. Thank you, Ronald. That was lovely. Now, thanks for introducing us to your new memoir, but where can listeners buy Fortunate Isle?
Fortunate Isle can be ordered through any bookseller, mm-hmm. and it's available on Amazon throughout the world. Okay. I've already had friends buy it in Australia, Venezuela, Mexico, Spain, and the United Kingdom, as well as Canada and the US.
Fabulous. Okay. And listeners, to connect with us, please send your comments, queries, or suggestions for whom we might interview in future programs to our website, wordonthehills.com. At the website, you'll find all our programs archived, so you can listen to them anywhere and at any time. We'd love to hear from you, so do stop by. And thanks for tuning in today. We hope you'll join us for another program next week, at Sunday at 1 p.m. right here on Northumberland 897 Truly Local Radio.